morning, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning to take your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, we'll be glad to talk to you about whatever's on your mind in those categories. If you have a difference of opinion from the host and would like to bring that up here, feel free to do that. You're always welcome to disagree. The purpose of the program has nothing to do with just showcasing the viewpoints of the host. It may be that as you listen to this program regularly, you'll find that some of the viewpoints of the host are not the viewpoints you've heard before on some subjects, and that is not with any mind to be controversial or to press these opinions of the host on the public. It's just after 43 years of teaching the Bible, there are some conclusions I've reached that are in some cases different than what I held when I was younger, and maybe from what you've heard. Mine is not the last word on any subject. The Word of God is the last word on every subject, and if you hear something you disagree with here, feel free to call and say why. We'd be glad to have you balance comment. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. And if my voice sounds a little more masculine than usual today, it's because I have a cold. And it always does wonderful things for my voice when I have a cold. I feel so much more testosterone-charged, but really not very comfortable. Anyway, I think my voice does sound a little lower today. And that is the reason, if you're wondering if it's really me, it is. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Earl calling from El Cajon, California. Earl, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Morning, Steve.
Hi.
Yeah, your voice does sound good, though, even though you got a cold. It does sound good.
I wish it sounded this way all the time.
Yeah.
But didn't feel this way.
Yeah, I have a question, and I want to ask the question, and then I will listen to the answer over the air. But I attend a church where we will take the Lord's Supper at the first of every month, and I really enjoy it. And I've been a Christian for 28 years or so, and so I understand the symbolism, the total symbolism of taking of the Lord's Supper, and how I apply it to my own life. You know, I examine myself when I do. But the part of it kind of bothers me, because I know that the pastor, I know it's for a believer, but there's also the other half of the statement about being for believers is that it brings judgment to those that partake of the Lord's table without examining their heart. My question is this. Looking at this whole ceremony through the eyes of grace, I don't believe that a person that is partaking of the Lord's Supper unknowingly or ignorantly will say, I don't know if that's the right word, but I don't think it's nothing more than a ceremony to some people, but some people that are mature Christians, they understand it. And in
so,
those
Earl,
cases,
I'm not hearing what your question is here. I'm not getting a question out of this.
Okay. Do you agree with a lot of the teaching is that the partaking of the Lord's Supper is strictly for Christians, and then if you're an unbeliever, you should not partake of the ceremony?
Okay. Well, it is true that the Lord's Supper is just for Christians. But if you're worried that an unbeliever might take it ignorantly and then bring judgment on themselves, as you seem to have mentioned in part of your introductory comments, that may come from a misunderstanding that people often bring to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, when Paul is telling the Corinthians that the way that they are taking the Lord's Supper is really quite a reproach to Christ. And those who are doing it that way are, in a sense, profaning something sacred and therefore bringing condemnation upon themselves. He's not talking about cases where unbelievers happen to be in the meeting and end up taking the Lord's Supper inappropriately. He's talking about actually the church, which is made up of believers, turning the Lord's Supper into a travesty. He said, see, what we have to understand is when we go to church to take the Lord's Supper, we usually get a little bit of a cracker served to us and a little tiny thimble full of grape juice or wine. And, it's hard to know how you could do anything wrong with that. So you assume that if I'm taking it unworthily, it must be that my heart's bad, or maybe I'm not a good enough Christian or something. But when Paul's talking about the Lord's Supper, he's talking about something that took place at a meal. The early Christians had what they called a love feast, and at the feast, they would also take the elements of communion, apparently, to commemorate the body and the blood of Christ. Now, this feast was like at a big potluck or a place where the serving bowls were in the middle of the table and people could take what they wanted for themselves. And Paul says people were being very selfish and taking more for themselves than they should so that others end up not getting enough. He said some of the people were going away hungry and others, because they were taking too much, were going away drunk. In other words, what was supposed to be a love feast was nothing but people, gorging themselves. So, first come, first serve takes the most food. And it was totally a selfish thing. And so instead of an act of worship and an act of communion and an act of commemoration of Christ, it was just, people taking as much as they could get for themselves and not caring whether anyone else had any. Now, that is what Paul describes taking place there. And he says that they are thus taking the Lord's Supper unworthily. And so he says in verse 27 of 1 Corinthians 11, he says, therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. So let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of that bread and drink that cup. In other words, check out what you're doing. Look at yourself. Look at your behavior. You're doing this in an unworthy way. And when you turn, a godly ceremony into something that's just a carnal, gluttonous, self-indulgent feast, well, then you are definitely profaning it. Now, he's not here talking at all about the circumstance where an unbeliever may come into one of our churches when we're taking communion, and they don't know better, so they go ahead and take some of that cracker and some of that that thimbleful of grape juice and bring some kind of condemnation on themselves. Paul's not talking about that at all. When he talks about someone taking it, the King James says, eating the, drinking the cup and eating the bread unworthily, the King James says. It makes many people think that, I have to be worthy to do this, because he says, I can't do it unworthily, so I have to be worthy. Now, it means, and all the modern translations say this, in an unworthy manner. He's not talking about you being an unworthy person. He's talking about the manner in which it's done being an unworthy manner. And he's talking about the sacrilegious manner in which the Corinthians are partaking of this. So he's not describing, condemnation coming on somebody because they're not qualified to take communion. He's talking about people who are turning the thing into a travesty. Now, on the other hand, you ask, do I think that communion is only for believers? It is only for believers. But there's no penalty attached, as near as I can tell, to an unbeliever taking it. It is, after all, in my understanding, really just bread and really just wine or grape juice. I don't believe it really turns into the body and blood of Christ as some groups do. And therefore, to the person who isn't commemorating their salvation through it, it's just eating another piece of bread and drinking another sip of wine. There's no harm done. There's no magic in the food. There's no magic in the drink. It's just food. But it's a commemoration. And because it is, it should only be commemorated really by Christians who actually have something to commemorate there. But if somebody else does, there's no penalties attached to it that the Bible would ever indicate. So I hope that clarifies that for you, Earl. Let's talk to Jim from Sacramento, California. Hi, Jim. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Good. Good to hear from you.
Good. Hey, I'm calling. Do you know who Dan Savage is?
Dan Savage. The name doesn't sound familiar
to
me.
He's spokesman for he's a theoretical spokesman for anti-bullying in America, and he's homosexual.
Okay.
He was recently videotaped giving high school journalism kids a hard time at a journalism seminar. He referred to Titus 2:9 about bondservants, and he said that if the Apostle Paul was wrong about Titus 2:9, then he's probably wrong about homosexuality and the Bible in general. And I find the guy not very pleasant, but playing like devil's advocate, it is kind of confusing about Paul telling slaves to obey their slave owner.
Titus 2:9, Paul says, exhort servants to be obedient to their own masters, to be well-pleasing in all things, not answering back. This is not the only place Paul instructs servants that way, and Peter gives the same instructions to servants in chapter 2 of his first epistle. It's a very common instruction to servants, I'm sure that this gentleman probably doesn't think that Paul was right in telling wives to submit to their husbands either. But to say that Paul was wrong is not enough. We have to say how we know that he was wrong. How do we know Paul was wrong about that? I don't know that he was wrong. I don't have any evidence that Paul was wrong. To say that Paul's opinion runs counter to political correctness, or to say that Paul's opinion runs counter to modern thinking, is not the same thing as saying Paul was wrong. That would be assuming that all change is progress, and that changes of opinion in a society is an improvement. That's not always the case. Sometimes changes of opinion are not an improvement. Now, if we had servants in our society, it would be correct instruction to give them to be polite and obedient to their masters, just like it's correct to tell children to be obedient to their parents, or wives to submit to their husbands, or we would tell citizens to submit to the authorities, or employees to submit to their bosses. There's nothing wrong with these instructions. They may not be egalitarian and democratic, but the Bible doesn't ever say that egalitarian and democratic principles must govern all institutions.
Yeah, I agree with
or
you.
Or any for that matter.
He referred to American slave ownership and comparing that to Titus 2:9. Are they the same?
Well, there's nothing original about his complaint. People do this all the time. They say, see, Paul was in favor of slavery. Now think about slavery. We're thinking about black slavery in the South. Well, why should we have to think about that? Because we're way out of touch with history. The only slavery we even know about is, you know, that which we learn about in Uncle Tom's Cabin. And the truth of the matter is, the slavery which was practiced in this country would have been condemned in the Bible because it involved kidnapping. In the law of Moses, a kidnapper was put to death. The slaves who were brought here from Africa in the institution that's usually called Atlantic slavery, they were kidnapped from their homes, from their families, and taken across the country and sold as property. That would be the slave traders who did that would have been put to death if the law of Moses was followed. When the Bible talks about slavery, it's not talking about kidnapping people. It's talking about an economic institution that was the salvation of many people who couldn't take care of themselves. In the Bible, people commonly sold themselves into slavery. Yeah, there were some people who were involuntary slaves. There were people who were prisoners of war, people who, instead of being killed in battle, they were taken back and became servants of their captors. This is not the same thing as kidnapping, because these are people who were making war against Israel, and they lost. If someone's making war and they lose, you know, when people fight against you, they might get killed, they might get captured. You know, when you make war, you're kind of taking your fate into your hands in a different sense than if you're just walking through the jungle and someone throws a net over you. Kidnapping is one thing. Prisoners of war are not the same thing. But by the way, most of the slaves in Israel, in all likelihood, were people who sold themselves into slavery. Because the Bible said that there were times when people could not pay their debts, and so they would sell themselves into slavery. Why? Because their master then would pay off their debts and take care of them and their family. All of their medical, their housing, their clothing, their food would be taken care of for the rest of their lives. That was the fate of a slave. Now, what did they have to give up for that? They had to give up freedom. Now, in modern America, freedom is the one thing we value probably more than anything, at least many of us. And therefore, to give up one's freedom for that kind of security is a choice most of us who are conservatives would not wish to make. However, it is a mentality that many liberals are not afraid of today. Many people want to give up their freedoms, their liberties, in order to get more security and have sort of a slave state and a nanny state. It's not really much different in principle. Throughout history, all societies allowed people to sell themselves into slavery and therefore allowed people to own slaves. But what Paul said is that people who own slaves should treat them like brothers. That was radical. That was radically different in that time. People generally treated their slaves just like property, like animals. Paul said, treat your slaves like brothers. And you slaves, be good to your masters. In other words, Paul had no reason to want to eliminate slavery any more than if he was in America, he'd necessarily eliminate charities that help the poor. Slavery was something that helped the poor. When they couldn't get out of a hole they dug and they couldn't take care of themselves, they could sell themselves into slavery and then all their bills would be paid and all their needs would be supplied for themselves and their families for the rest of their lives. That's not really that bad a deal. We just wouldn't want it. I wouldn't want it because I wouldn't want to give up my freedom. But I might prefer to give up my freedom to giving up my life because I couldn't eat. So we, you know, here we are in prosperous Western culture where we haven't had slavery for over 100 years in our culture. And we're trying to pass judgment on Paul's instructions to people who were in a culture that resembled every culture in the world for the first 6,000 years. I don't really think Paul can be said to be wrong about this. Paul didn't establish slavery. He just told people who were slaves how to behave, just like he told other people how to behave.
Can we take it either? I took it to another level that true Christians, true followers of Christ, were slaves to Christ, and being a slave
exactly.
is not a bad thing. So, okay.
That's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7. Yeah. Okay, Jim.
Okay.
Thanks for your call.
God bless you, and I appreciate your time.
All right. Bye now. Paul did say that about slaves and Christians in general in 1 Corinthians 7. He said that a man who is a slave but a Christian is the Lord's free man. That is, he has liberty in Christ. He's still a slave as far as his circumstances are concerned, but he's inwardly a free man. And he said that he that is a free man and a Christian is the Lord's slave. In other words, when you become a Christian, you actually give away your freedoms to the Lord. Anyway, you become the servant of God, and he becomes your owner. So, I mean, we need to be careful not to have a knee-jerk response to words that have come to mean something or carry certain feelings in our culture, like the word slavery. If we just decide slavery is always an evil thing, well, probably we don't know as much about slavery as we should. We only know that in this country, slavery was a very bad thing, and that's true. And it's not only associated with kidnapping, it's also associated with racism in this country. Often that wasn't true in the Bible. It was a Jewish man sold himself into slavery to a Jewish owner. There was no racism involved. The slavery in the Bible was not the same thing as what we call Atlantic slavery, where African people were kidnapped from their homes and brought over here and sold to white people and then treated badly. That was bad. That institution needed to be condemned, and the persons who perpetrated it should have been, under biblical law, would have been stoned to death, the slave traders. So the Bible does not support that. What the Bible supports is an economic system that allows people to trade away their freedom for financial security, which is what slavery was. Okay, let's talk to who's next here. Wynn from Palos Verdes, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Wynn.
Good morning, Steve.
Hi.
Hi, hope you feel better from your cold.
Thank you. I will eventually.
My question is about somewhere in Revelation chapter 12. It talked about the Gentile will trample the holy temple for 42 months. That's 3.5 years of period. And what do you think about that? Like, you also talk about the woman being rescued from the dragon for 1,260 days. That's also 3.5 years. And also in the book of Daniel, it talked about the final seven, about the person like confirming the covenant.
Yeah.
And then in the middle of the seven, he breaks the covenant. Are they related? And what's your view on that?
Okay, Wynn, I appreciate your call. And there's not a short answer to that, because when I answer a question like that, I try to survey the common opinions as well as tell what my own opinion is. I can give you at least three different opinions that evangelicals hold right now about those passages that talk about the 3.5 years. The most popular opinion on radio and media today among Christians is that the 3.5 years represents a period of that length at the end of the world as we know it. And many such people believe there are two such periods back to back, making a 7-year period, which they call the tribulation. These people believe that the church will be raptured out of the earth, and then there will be a 7-year period of tribulation. And the last 3.5 years of that they call the Great Tribulation, which is, I guess, worse than the first 3.5 years. There is nothing in the Bible that speaks of a 7-year tribulation, although you mentioned Daniel chapter 9, which does talk about the weeks of Daniel, but there's no place in Daniel that would suggest that the 70th week, which is popularly associated with the tribulation, Daniel doesn't say that the 70th week is a tribulation, and certainly does not indicate that the 70th week is going to be at the end of the world. The 70th week presumably followed the 69th week, which all dispensationalists agree occurred when Jesus was here on the earth. So the 70 weeks of Daniel, if we take the passage literally, occurred thousands of years ago, and there is no future 70th week of Daniel to look for. There is no place in the Bible that mentions a 7-year tribulation, but people sometimes get it from, again, the identifying of the 70th week of Daniel with the tribulation, and also the 3.5 years, which is mentioned 5 times in the book of Revelation and a few times in Daniel. To my mind, the 3.5 years in Revelation probably, at least most reasonably, in the absence of information to the contrary, is probably the same 3.5 years every time it's mentioned. To say there are two periods of 3.5 years is an artificial construct placed upon Revelation by imposing the idea that we're talking about the 70th week of Daniel here, which is obviously 7 years, and therefore they would say, well, since the tribulation is the 70th week of Daniel, it's 7 years, then whenever in Revelation we read about 3.5 years, it must be either the first half or the second half of that 7 years. This is all artificial. If you didn't have assumptions you're bringing to that, and you just read the book of Revelation, you'd probably have the impression, as I myself do now, I used to be a dispensationalist, but I now believe that the 3.5 years is always talking about the same period of time. Now, there's a group of people who don't believe that that's talking about the future at all, but that that's talking about the Jewish war, or alternately, the period of time that Nero persecuted the church. Both of those periods were about 3.5 years and occurred in the first century. Nero persecuted the church from 64 AD to his suicide in 68 AD. And the Jewish war began in June of 66 AD and ended in 70 AD and was thus about 3.5 years also. Many people believe that the 3.5 years in Revelation and in Daniel is referring to this period of time, which those two periods of time were rather almost coextensive. But the point is, that is another view. So you've got Christians who take the 3.5 years to be a future period of time. There's those who take it to be a past and fulfilled period of time. And then there's another view, and that's a view that I actually lean toward, and that is that the number is symbolic, that the period of time is symbolic, and it's not literally 3.5 years, nor is the 1,000 years in Revelation 20 literally 1,000 years, nor is the 10 days in Revelation 2:10, in which the church of Smyrna is persecuted for 10 days. That's not a literal 10 days. Nor is the 1 hour a literal hour when it says in Revelation 17 that the nations will give their power for 1 hour to the beast. These time designations in Revelation are not necessarily literal. I don't believe the 1 hour is literal, the 10 days are literal, the 1,000 years are literal, or the 3.5 years are literal. I believe they all have symbolic value. Now, nobody's obligated to agree with me about this, but you asked my opinion, and that is my opinion. And I personally think the period of time spoken of there represents the age of the church, though And that's a fairly common view among some Christians, too, but there's obviously the other alternatives views available. Wynn, I appreciate your call. I'm going to try to get Chuck in before we're out of time here. Chuck from Santa Ana, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is on Matthew 22, I believe it's verse 23, the high priest are questioning Jesus about a man who is married and he dies, and the Jewish custom is for the brother to marry the wife. Do you follow that one? Do you follow that?
Yeah, that's when the Sadducees came to Jesus, and they posed a hypothetical to him about a woman who married seven men successively because they each died, yeah.
And then they ask him, who is she? Who is... Hello?
Yes, yes, you're going to have to hurry because we're almost out of time. Go ahead. State your question.
Okay, and so he they ask him, who is she married to? And then he says to them that you err or do not know the scripture. And then he answers them with, they'll become as angels. Now, that right there, that part where he says as angels, is that a clue to what we become after we, you know, leave this?
Well, I don't believe that we become angels when we die, but Jesus said that in the resurrection we will be like the angels in one respect anyway, and that is that we won't be getting married in the next life. The angels don't either. There's no need for the angels to get married, apparently, and there won't be any need for us to get married in the resurrection. But we will be different than the angels. The angels are spirits, the Bible says in Hebrews 1:14. They are ministering spirits. But we will be in bodies. We will be resurrected from the dead out of the grave. And so we will not be angels. We'll be a different order of being. But we will have that in common with angels, that neither they nor we will be getting married. That's the most we can really derive from Jesus' statement there. And that's the most I have time to say today because we're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this every weekday at the same time. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to find out how to help us stay on the air, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. And also, I'm speaking in Temecula this Saturday. You'll find out more about that at the website, too, thenarrowpath.com. Thank you.